Hi, everyone. Today, we're fortunate to have three members of the leadership team from the Humane Rescue Alliance based in Washington, D.C., and also in Madison, New Jersey. We are joined by Chris Schindler, who is the Vice President of Field Services, Claudia Roll, who is Vice President of Operations, and Stephanie Shane, who's the Chief Operating Officer. So welcome, all of you. Thank you for being a part of this conversation today.
Hey, Catherine.
Yeah, thank you.
And Claudia, you really got us started on this topic because you and I were recently on a Zoom call and we were talking about the challenges of helping everyone understand the importance of open adoption philosophy and how it has changed the way that animal shelters have set out to adopt, whether they're looking at policy or protocol changes. And so part of that conversation included your recommendation for those of us who've been in the field for a length of time to really sort of share our own personal journeys and epiphanies of what open adoptions really has meant to us personally as well as professionally. So I'd like to hear from each one of you a little bit about your background. When did you start in animal welfare? What type of positions have you had? And what was, when you entered into this field, what were some of the philosophical beliefs that you held to be true? So Chris, do you want to start off?
Oh, wow. You got to call me out first. I mean, this was Claudia's, you know.
She paid me. She paid me to...
I know, seriously. So yeah, I mean, it's been 24 years that I got into animal welfare, and I actually started cleaning kennels as a teenager, which is kind of where I kind of came up in sheltering, and realized when I saw an officer for the first time, I was like, that's what I want to do. I'm going to be, you know, I want to be an officer. And so worked really hard towards that. So I served in a lot of different positions in sheltering before I became an officer doing, you know, I was doing sheltering work. I was a manager, you know, sheltering. I did vet tech work and dispatch and everything in between, just trying to figure out, you know, my path to where I wanted to be. But it was so much different, obviously, in the 90s, sheltering when I first started. And, you know, most definitely people were not going to get an animal if they didn't check every single box. And actually, even I was trying to adopt a cat when I was working at the first shelter I worked at. And I was a supervisor at the time and had a significant hurdles even for me to qualify to adopt a cat from a place in which I was the supervisor and providing overseeing care for that animal, which at the time I didn't even think of as being so wild, right? Like that I couldn't even, you know, I had to go through all these hoops and felt like, well, yeah, of course people should, right? Like that, you know, we need to protect the animals. And then realized, obviously, some years later, as things evolved, that like this is insanity, right? All these animals that we withheld from getting really amazing homes, much like my home, right, would have been amazing, even though, you know, they thought I didn't check some of the boxes. And the reality was we had, you know, inadvertently overprotected animals to the point where they were disadvantaged from getting good homes. And, you know, I was lucky enough to then go to WHS at some point where, you know, I always felt like we were so much, you know, we had a lot of work to do, but, you know, there was a lot of progressive mindset, which I think really opened up my mind as we move forward and changed a lot of procedures even going forward. But that's my short story. I'm sure I have a lot more to share. But.
So when you, just to make sure everyone fully understands this, the scope of your rejection as an adopter, you actually worked at this shelter. You were in charge of ensuring the animals were safe and cared for, and you applied to adopt and you were rejected.
Yeah, but initially I was rejected. I ended up being able to adopt in the end, but after like months of issues, and it was, you know, I was a teenager at the time, lived on my own. But it was because, you know, my past history with pets was my family's pets, and my family did not take, our animals did not go to the vet. Like, let's be real. Like, they just didn't, you know, most of our dogs lived chained up in the backyard growing up. And so my having to use my family's history as like a background, even though I was an employee there and in charge of care, was not, did not meet that criteria for adoption.
So I can't imagine what it's like to actually be working in the shelter and being responsible for those animals. And then, you know, you said something interesting that you seemed to understand when they denied you the adoption.
Yeah.
Is that just how you conveniently want to remember it?
No, I mean, it really was, because it was like, you know, I feel like it was just so ingrained in you, you know what I mean? The whole process. And when you're talking to people, you know, working in the shelter, part of our job was also to talk to potential adopters and like get information, you know what I mean? While they're looking at animals and things like that. And so it seemed to make sense at the time that like, well, of course we have to have this high bar and like, I shouldn't be like excluded from that. While at the same time being wounded from it, right? It's like, you know, I take care of this cat every day and I really want, you know, I really want to adopt this cat because I love this cat. But it was certainly, you know, really eye-opening, I think, later as like things sort of evolved, that like, wow, that was so wrong, right? You know, and so wrong to so many other people who also wanted to give a pet a home that were rejected.
So you were actually able to adopt the cat a few months later.
I was, through some of the, you know, I had done a lot of stuff. The president of the board, I had helped her. I did a lot of stuff like, you know, non-work related stuff. She had some mobility issues, and so I helped her a lot. And I had been talking to her one day, and she was like, are you kidding me? That, you know, it was just random conversation. And then, you know, I ended up being able to adopt the cat.
Wow.
You had to get special permission.
Yeah.
From the board president.
Yeah. From the board president. Yeah.
Nice work. Mm-hmm. Nice way to work it, Chris.
Yeah. I know. You know, what am I going to, what are you?
You actually can't make this story up. Like, this is a true story. So obviously we aren't going to name names and talk about that shelter that you were rejected by, but do you feel that experience had prepared you for a journey of compassion towards open adoptions, or did you struggle with, when open adoptions, you know, came around about 10 years ago, did you fight it at all personally? Did you feel like it didn't align with your personal values?
I mean, I think I still had some, you know, I then was a humane law enforcement officer, and we did home checks, actually. We were doing the home checks often. And so it was a little bit, it wasn't complete resistance, but it did kind of feel like we dealt with so many different cases of animal cruelty, right? And like, do we need to see all of these things? But then it really, I think as we started to get rid of that policy, it was really like, why do we care so much about having somebody give us a tour of their entire home, right? Like, anybody could let me into their house and tell me they're going to be a good pet owner, but does that really equal a good pet owner? It doesn't. And so I think for me, it clicked a little bit earlier of like, I really don't need to see somebody's house to know whether or not they're going to be a good pet owner, right? Like, it's really worthless. You know, much like a lot of the other different things. Like, I feel like I'm an excellent pet owner and was back then, and our family's pets were taken good care of. But yeah, I mean, we didn't take them to the vet necessarily as much as we should have, but we never let them suffer, you know what I mean, for medical conditions. And I think that's one of those things that we got too caught up in the earlier years, right, of wanting to force that issue to make everybody feel good about sending an animal home.
Right. That was very much about control and making sure that you could control the environment of the animal.
Yeah.
And I remember when I first started in 1996, it was an application that was 4 pages and required a landlord's approval. And we would deny people if they didn't have a fenced-in yard. And I believed wholeheartedly that we were doing the right thing. It was absolutely, made absolute sense to me. So, well, Claudia, tell us about your story. When did you start in animal welfare, and what were some of the philosophies you held back then?
I started in animal welfare about 24 years ago, was my first paying job in the field, as a humane educator in Baltimore. But before that, I started tagging along with a friend of mine to her job at one of the humane societies in Maryland. And I was a clean slate. I didn't know anything about animal sheltering. So what this clean slate learned is you better not adopt out black cats for at least the couple of weeks before Halloween, because of all, you know, the horrible things that people are going to do. And then I still think about, you know, now I think back at those black cats that sat there. And you also better stop adoptions at least a week before Christmas, because someone might give one as a gift. So those were just kind of the things that I soaked up. People I respected, some people I'm still friends with that have been on a similar journey that I have been on. When I became a humane educator, I was with a non-sheltering organization. So I was just pulling whatever information I could find, and there wasn't everything on the internet back then. So one thing I really remember struggling with was TNR and reading what the lifespan was thought to be of a feral cat, because we didn't say community cat yet. And I really struggled about putting a cat back out. In my thinking, it felt like a slow, horrible death. Lonely, horrible death. So I really struggled with that. Fast forward out of my humane education years, and I was out in New Mexico managing a mobile spay-neuter clinic, and found myself advocating with a really progressive town on the Navajo Nation who wanted to do TNR for community dogs. And so that was, and I spent a lot of time out there. I, you know, knew the community and was all for that. So that was one of the shifts I started to see in myself. So I worked in spay neuter, also did some lobbying at the state level in New Mexico, before really getting into shelter operations in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And then I have been with HRA for 9 years, various positions in the shelter.
Were you at any point an adoption counselor? Did you find yourself denying adoptions to people?
I didn't do a lot of adoptions myself as an adoption counselor, but staff would come to me just like, oh, I don't know. When I came to HRA, it was Washington Humane Society at the time, the home visits had not that long ago stopped, and just like real, just starting to creep into open adoptions. And I felt comfortable with that. The fee waived adoptions, that sort of threw us for a loop, both personally, and then when we started to come around to the idea, you know, the public just really slamming us for it. But, you know, so those were things that I really had to sit with, and it certainly wasn't an immediate, you know, the fee waived adoptions. You know, we used to, not that long ago, have a rule that every member of the family had to meet the animal that was going to be adopted. Yeah. And it didn't matter what that animal was. It just, and Stephanie, I often think of the kitten you took home.
I'm just remembering, like, I forgot about the fee waived adoption drama. Like,
big drama.
Yeah, I forgot about that. And that's in our recent history. Like, that's not long ago.
Very, very deal. Recent. Yeah. One thing that sticks in my mind over the years are adoption applications that were denied because of toddlers in the home. Mm. So I guess you can't grow up with a dog. Maybe certain dogs, I get that. But it's been very interesting. And I think the point and why this came up on that Zoom call, Catherine, is every step along the way, we've like fully believed that we've been doing the right thing. Yep. I often think, what are we doing now that we'll look back on? Who knows?
That's a really great point, Claudia. And I think you and I are about the same in terms of length of service, if you will, to animal welfare. I've been doing it for 25 years, and I share some of those very same issues that you elaborated on. So very much concerned about feral cats. And I was taught that a humane death was better than them freezing to death or being tortured or being hit by a car. And Absolutely. I went on television for 7 years in a row and talked about the importance of pulling black cats for Halloween. Mm. I have press clippings of photos of me talking to the community about the satanic rituals that we were protecting those cats from. Mm. And it's actually a really interesting sort of funny story that I share, because I totally agree with you. I was 100% on board. You know, I absolutely felt that we were doing the right thing and we were protecting the animals and we were saving them. And they had already been through so much, having been abandoned. And so I definitely can relate to everything. And I will tell you, when the fee waived adoptions came, I was the CEO of Asheville Humane Society, and I was horrible. I was just completely against it. I argued with my vice president of operations, and I just thought, look, we already know that if you don't pay a significant adoption fee, you're not going to value that animal, because that's what I was taught. And I remember she was so frustrated with me, and she just kept coming back to me and asking if we could try the fee waived adoptions. And I was really getting irritated and frustrated that she kept bringing this ridiculous idea up. And so one day she just got really mad at me and walked out of my office. I ran down the end of the hall and I was like, why do you want to do this so badly? What is so, you know, what is so appealing about fee-waived adoptions? And she whipped around in her chair and she had this horrible look on her face. And she said, I'm tired of killing cats. And she said it in such a way that made me realize I didn't carry that burden of making the euthanasia list. She did. Yeah. And if I couldn't be there to support her and to explore this with her, that was irresponsible, you know, as a leader, yeah, as a colleague, as an animal welfare advocate. And I had such great respect for her that I had to really check myself and say, okay, we can try it. So of course I went home to my husband and said, well, we're going to have to work on Saturday. And you're going to have to go to the shelter with me, because we're going to have to work the front desk, because we're holding a fee waived adoption for cats. Mm-hmm. And I need to be there because God only knows what kind of people are going to show up. And so I remember that day so vividly, because it was a day where everything that I believed in, everything that I knew to be true, came front and center when all these people showed up. And it was our first ever fee waived adoption for adult cats. And by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we had run out of cats in the shelter. Mm. We didn't have any more cats. And I kept thinking, you've got to be kidding. I actually remember calling our foster coordinator and saying, bring in foster animals. I don't care that they're not ready. Let's just... And we ended up giving people rain checks and saying, hey, wow, we're so glad you came in. And I made sure that we took adoption photos of every family individual who came in to adopt, because I wanted to remind myself that these horrible people were the people that came in every day. These were the people that they just wanted a cat. And this fee waived adoption was a tool to drive traffic to the shelter. And I had fought it for so long. So literally in one day, I went from being an absolute laggard, like refused to change, to being like the biggest advocate for fee-waived adoptions. It was transformative for me. But I remember I really struggled with it. It was really hard. So, Stephanie, what about you? Let's hear your story. How did you first start in animal welfare? And did you share any similar stories as the rest of us?
Yeah. I mean, I started out, my first shelter job, I was at a volunteer and had an interesting volunteer experience, like so many of us years ago, that it was like a horrible volunteer experience. That I just thought, I am going to keep coming back, even though you act like you don't want me here. I am just going to keep coming back. But I ended up working there. And you know, I think, Catherine, what you just said about that your employee said about, I'm tired of killing cats. I do think there is for many people, you know, to change your mind, it's a courageous thing to change your mind, because sometimes it makes you confront, you know, you do the best you can. You make the best decisions with the information you have at the time. But if you have a story about why you can't do something and then you change your mind, sometimes you have to confront what was the impact of those decisions. Mm-hmm. So think of that first shelter job I had, even when I was a volunteer. We told ourselves those stories in some part to protect ourselves, because it was, well, we have no choice. You know, you're doing massive euthanasia at the end of every day. And it was because we didn't have a choice. And so I just think somewhere deep inside, those things, we create those things to protect ourselves. I, you know, I was doing the math while you guys were talking, and I thought, oh, I guess I haven't been doing this as long as Chris Schindler and Claudia Roll. And then I realized I was doing my math wrong. So 10 years older than I was doing my math. So, it's almost in a couple of months, it'll be 30 years doing, since I started in volunteering at a shelter. And I don't remember so much our restrictions, although it was 30 years ago. I know we had them. I think what sticks out in my mind more than anything is my experience as an adopter. And the things that changed my mind were my experience as an adopter. So you know, I've worked in animal rights organizations. I've worked in animal welfare organizations. I've worked in animal shelters. I'm a vegan, like I'm all in. And so when I tried to adopt, a hamster with my daughter. So my daughter would have been like 8 at the time, and the shelter would not adopt unless my husband came to the shelter to meet the hamster, because they had that rule that everyone has to meet the animal. And it was like, my husband will never, like, this is me and my daughter, we're going to take care of the hamster. But they would not adopt that hamster to us unless my husband drove the 45 minutes, which is how far we had to drive to get to a shelter that had a hamster, even though we could have bought a hamster 10 minutes from our house. I think of the story of a family member who got a dog from a rescue group many states away. The rescue group had all these rules, and they answered all the questions the way that they knew they were supposed to answer them. They had to send a photo of their fenced-in backyard, send a photo of somebody else's fenced-in backyard. So it was like that experience was like, it's not even working. Like, people just know how to lie. We're teaching them to lie to us. And so when I tried to adopt a dog, by that point I had a second daughter. And when my husband and I went to adopt a dog, we had both grown up with big dogs. We went to adopt a dog, and we were told big dogs can't live with little kids. So when I told a couple of, you know, a friend and a family member about that experience, they both immediately offered to go adopt the dog for us. Just give us the dog after. So it was like, wow, all these rules we have in place, and people learn how to game the system when there are stupid rules in place. And so I think it was maybe those experiences sort of on the other side of the counter really made me start rethinking all these rules that I used to believe in, and that gave me comfort. Not only that I felt like I was protecting the animals who were in my charge, which is very important, but I also used that to comfort myself when there were too many kittens at the end of the day. We had to euthanize X number of kittens, or go, we've got too many orange cats, go pull two. It was like, well, this is better than them going into XYZ. And certainly I would never want an animal to go into a bad situation, but it was like, what are the actual odds that that cat is going to go into a bad situation? And I wish I could remember who it was that had said to me years ago that they said, you know, maybe the dog doesn't sleep on the bed. Maybe this animal goes to a home that isn't just like ours, but doesn't make it a bad home. It doesn't make that dog's life not happy and enriched and well. So I don't remember those light bulb moments so much. Like, Catherine, your story is amazing that you had this light bulb moment in the shelter. I don't remember those so much. I remember I think what I really remember, and really part of what changed my mind, was how horrible it felt to be the person that wanted the animal. Like, I'm doing the right thing. I'm here. I've got my kid. I've got the, you know, like, I've done all the things. And I think that's more than anything what changed my mind, was like, this isn't helping us, because now I'm pissed. Like, I'm embarrassed because I'm standing in the shelter with my husband or the kid or whomever. I'm embarrassed because I can't get a dog. And I'm walking away feeling really bad about this organization and feeling like, what's wrong with me? I'll do all the things. And so it was like those multiple sort of like little, you know, acorns to the head over time made me think, what are we doing to people? And we're turning them away from us. And the one of the phrases I just can't stand, that I don't hear near as much as I used to, is it's easier to adopt a child than adopt a dog. And you don't want people to feel like that. I mean, it's a silly thing to compare, but for people to feel like that, it's like, those are people who might save an animal's life because there's an animal there that needs a home. And if they're going in feeling like this is going to be terrible, then we've lost that chance. And I don't want anybody to come to my home just because I don't want to think about how I got to clean my bathroom now or something. Like, it's like, hide. It's just like, my house is a mess. I got laundry to fold, and that we expect people to do that seems so invasive.
I definitely agree with you, Stephanie. I feel that during my epiphany, when I realized the only difference in the experience was, we had adoption counseling where you paid an adoption fee, and we had adoption counseling when you didn't pay a fee. But the experience for the adopter was exactly the same. The same conversation, right. The adoption counseling process didn't change. The educational component of those adoptions didn't change. And so it was, for me, just really challenging to understand why I fought this in such a significant way, because I really did fight it. And I think you shared something, Stephanie, that really hits home with me, is I realized those 7 years where I shared with the community that we needed to protect Black cats by removing them from the adoption floor and having them put in the back of the shelter. I know what happened to those cats. They got stressed, their immune systems became weaker, they got sick, and they got euthanized. And I'm out there telling the entire community, we can't adopt Black cats to potential satanic ritual people who are coming in to adopt them. And it just sort of the realization of being responsible for that one piece of all those cats were, you know, on a guess, on a belief, on a story that somebody told somebody who told somebody, and all of a sudden there's a policy around it. And it is, I do think that after a while you want to believe that all the hard work that you've done has been good work, and that you want to really honor and respect the work that you've done. And so it was really hard for me. I really fought it, and it was very challenging, and it was very emotional. And, you know, but I'm so grateful for that point of view, because when I talk to younger employees that are just entering animal welfare, they are shocked by the stories that I tell them, and surprised to learn that, what do you mean that you used to euthanize a whole room full of puppies because one broke with parvo? And what do you mean you'd pull a cat off of the adoption floor because it sneezed? And it's just like, shelter medicine has done so much for life saving. And I just think back 25 years ago, and I can't even imagine if I could have sustained, if I hadn't gone through those changes and had those personal journeys and epiphanies, I don't know that I could have sustained being in animal welfare. So I think for all of the colleagues and our predecessors, the generation before us that didn't have the luxury of shelter medicine and didn't have those questioning opportunities, I hold them in even greater respect, because they didn't have that hope that we have, which I'm so grateful for.
Yeah. And I think it's like, I see as, like, you know, people who have been doing this, we've all been doing this a really long time. It's so critical. I'm so glad that you're doing this, Catherine, and talking about it, because it is so critical to talk about it, to help the people who, I mean, I feel like part of my job is certainly just to share ideas and hopefully spark some ideas in other people, and to always remind sort of the people that might be newer to this, like you just said, Catherine, don't count that person who has a hard and fast rule about something out. If you're talking with someone who absolutely believes that, you know, if you can't pay the adoption fee, you don't deserve the animal, just keep talking and sharing your experience. Because if somebody hadn't kept talking to us, if we hadn't had different experiences, then we would still be that person who's having that idea.
Oh, absolutely. You're absolutely right. And I'm grateful for, you know, my employees who were strong and courageous enough to disagree with me, because that took a lot on them. Chris, what are some of the things that you feel our industry is really struggling with right now that are lessons that we should be learning from the past? Or are we repeating some of those bad decisions from the past? Do you see that?
I mean, I think one of the things that I hear come up a lot, you know, and I mean, I hear it less and less frequently, but I mean, we still hear it, especially with the big adoption events, is like the fact, like the thought that dogs are going to be adopted to go to dog fighting, right? Like, you know, that's the other thing that's been around for a long time, but won't go away like that. Mm-hmm. Like, it just doesn't go away. I mean, I've actually written things for a number of shelters all over the country, just because of my history investigating dog fighting, for them to give to, like, their volunteers, like, and to their board members. And this is just within recent, I mean, this isn't like old. I mean, this is still happening now, is that, you know, there are a lot of people who are still heavily involved in sheltering that believe that. And I mean, I will say it a million times, like, it is 100% not true. Like, it just doesn't happen ever. Like, dog fighters are not adopting dogs from adoption events, and they're not adopting dogs from shelter. It is never, it has not happened, and it is not happening.
Oh, Chris, now come on, you know, they're,
yeah.
You know that those are bait dogs. Yeah. Those are bait dogs. Every time
they're just trying to trigger me. We're just trying.
Every time I see that on social media, it triggers me. And it's just you. And I get so frustrated. And then I have to remind myself, they have this misperception because they care and they love animals. And they're genuinely concerned and worried. And so I think our challenge right now in this particular time in animal mm-hmm. welfare is how do we help our colleagues who are still holding on to some of those yeah. myths? How do we help them arrive at a place where they're more comfortable with things like fee waived adoptions mm-hmm. or letting go of those landlord checks or home visits? And mm-hmm. it's something that I feel for those of us who've been in this field for a long time, we have the luxury of that experience and those journeys. Mm-hmm. And you can only write so many blogs, Chris, but what do you think we should be doing to help our colleagues better embrace or sort of take this journey towards realizing that home visits and landlord checks and other barriers to adoption aren't really helping animals in the long run?
Some of what helped me that we can all continue to do was some of the research, whether it's the national level or internally or regionally, about pets given as gifts, getting the information. Well, what happened to that animal? Because we learned a lot and it let us breathe a little easier. What about those fee waived adoptions? When we do fee waived events, we have a regular follow-up with adopters anyway, so we're able to get information. We, you know, track the return rates, see if they're any different than they were. Some of those things can be helpful. I mean, if somebody's not quite ready to hear that, there's still the, oh, well, you still don't know what happened to the animal. But for me, it wasn't a light bulb. And it was sort of one of these issues at a time. But for me, that was helpful. And I know it was helpful for a lot of my colleagues when we were sort of crossing our fingers about some of these things we started to do.
Yeah. Stephanie, what do you think? How can we help meet people where they are and help them take the leap of faith or the jump with us?
Well, I think some of it is, you know, how do I think we can help people? I think it's just being willing to have the connection with them, asking them, you know, what are you afraid is going to happen? And really listening, not sort of thinking of what you're going to answer, but like really listening, what are you afraid of, really? And trying to, you know, I think we all are best when we learn ourselves and figure it out ourselves. And so just having that conversation, being willing to do that. Being willing, you know, if you're in an organization that has an adoption perspective, inviting those groups in so that they can see, you know, so I guess it comes down to just being open with your time, being open with what you do in your organization so that other people come in and try to mm-hmm. pick it apart or find the flaw can help them. But just being willing to stay in that conversation, even if you get to a point you have to say, like, mm-hmm. you know, I think we need to talk again next week. I need a little break. But, you know, the danger is when we get frustrated and we shut those conversations down, which I understand how hard that can be. But we all learned somehow. And a lot of that was by our own personal experiences. So be willing to help someone have a personal experience.
I like that. I think that's
mm-hmm. very... I like that too. A heated debate isn't going to do it. Like you, Stephanie, you mentioned the frustration when
yeah.
listening, we bring it, you know, somebody will bring it up, but really it's so you can say what you're going to say.
I guess it's like, don't try to prove somebody wrong. Like I'm not trying right. to prove someone wrong. I want to be invitational. I want to be yeah. welcome. I want the person who has that really hard view and perspective to always feel like they can have a cordial conversation, that there's a friendly, welcoming person who's happy to talk to them about it. I'm not trying to prove them wrong. I'm just trying to show them a different perspective.
Yeah. I also think that social media is sort of a challenging place to have the conversation because so often people can misinterpret a comment or take offense when it wasn't intended. And, you know, I think our society right now has, you know, social media has become very hurtful in so many ways, but it's also saved a lot of lives and done amazing things. So I like the idea of, if you're encountering some of these debates on social media, instead of engaging, you know, back and forth on a thread, perhaps reach out, have that invitation and say, I'd love to talk to you on the phone about this, or let's jump on a Zoom call, or if we live in the same vicinity, let's meet for coffee and sit 6 feet apart so that we can, you know, talk about it. Because I think when, I think people are willing to listen when they know you care. And I think that opens them up to thinking a little differently. I know when I used to do new hire orientation at one of my shelters, I would tell the incoming junior staff, every single person that comes to the front door of a shelter is a hero because they have so many other choices. Less than 25% of animals that are sourced in America and become pets are coming from a shelter or a rescue group. Some estimates say 30%. It just depends. But that means that 1 out of 4 pets in America is coming from a shelter. And I want to see the day when 3 out of 4 pets are coming from a shelter or a rescue. And so people actually physically get in their car. They drive 45 minutes out of their way to go adopt a hamster when they could have just gone 10 minutes away to the local pet store and bought a hamster, where they would receive no adoption counseling. They would not be able to engage with an adoption counselor to talk to them. And for them to be denied and made to feel that they are less than is so demoralizing, because they had the best of intentions, and we have punished them for trying to do the right thing. So if you come, I used to share with the team, if you could just remember everybody that walks through our doors made a conscious choice to come do something good. And if you meet them at that space, it can, and your job is to educate and help, it changes the whole conversation. So,
you know, Catherine, it does. And you made me think of something. Like, even if that person doesn't adopt, leaving feeling good about the experience. It's like this weird thing with animal shelters, that if you have a bad experience at an animal shelter and you say, I'm never going to a shelter again, it's different than so many other things. If you were going to pick any other business that you go to, if you had a bad experience with business, you might say, I'm not going to that business, I'm going to go to a different one. But when I think of in my own personal life, people who I've talked to who have had the bad experience at a shelter say, I'm never going to a shelter again. Mm-hmm. It's like we get this broad brush image. So you're not only, it's like you're talking, there you got a lot of lives in your hands to make that good impression at your organization and everybody else's.
Right. And also, that doesn't, just because they don't adopt from you, or if you deny the adoption, that doesn't mean they're not going to get a pet. They're just going to go somewhere else. They're going to go to Craigslist. They're going to go to a pet store. They're going to source their pet, but you've missed the opportunity to engage with them and help them become an ambassador and an advocate for animal welfare. And I totally agree with you, Stephanie. I've heard the same thing. People have been denied, and they don't want, and they often, no matter where they live, they think the shelter experience is the same across the country.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think that's a really good point. Well, I really have loved hearing your stories, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk about where we've come from And I think the three of you do such amazing work at the Humane Rescue Alliance. And it's just a pleasure always to work with you and help elevate this profession and our industry. And I can't wait to see what HRA does next. But I love that we took this time to talk about where we've come from. And before we say goodbye, do you want to just one by one give any parting words of wisdom for that brand new employee or that brand new volunteer who's come into a shelter and their eyes are big and their hearts are open and their passion is just exploding? What do we need to teach them? What is the advice that we need to give them as they start their own animal welfare journey?
I would share that when people do come through our doors, that we should be assuming the best intent from people and that we are a bit of a mystery through our doors. And it means a lot that we have a responsibility, yes, to the animals, but we're here for the people in our community as well and really embrace the whole community. So.
Nice. I like that.
Nice.
Chris, what words of wisdom do you have?
I mean, these days, a lot of my words of wisdom are normally to our, like, you know, newer officers are coming on. And I, you know, I always feel like after being in the field for so long is that, you know, we always have to keep learning. And so I'm always, you know, trying to remind them is that we don't all know everything. I don't know everything. You know, our other senior staff and field services don't know everything. And, you know, I learned so much even from our newer staff. And so I'm always trying to remind everyone, you know, we didn't all become experts overnight and we're not the ultimate experts because none of us know everything. And I think we all need to, I think, practice that every day, is that, you know, so that our staff don't think that everything is going to come from us, right? And I think there's so many new and exciting things to learn every day.
I like that. Jeez. All right, Stephanie.
I think if I had to give words of advice, I would just say, like, don't believe everything you believe. Like, question everything you believe, because you might, I guess that would be it. Like, don't believe everything you believe, because we've all been proven wrong different times. And so stay open, because it'll be a lot more fun for you. And you'll discover really interesting things if you're not so busy staying stuck in your beliefs.
Well, I wish I had met you three when I first started 25 years ago. And I can't thank you enough for your time today. And let's keep having these conversations, because that's how we grow and learn. And thank you all for your leadership and for doing the amazing work at HRA. So we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Catherine.
Thank you, Catherine.